In a lengthy sermon where he enumerates some of the interpolations of the preceding ones, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam says, لقد عامل الولاة قبلي بأمور عظيمة خالفوا فيها رسول الله. Indeed, the rulers before me have committed grave actions by which they purposefully contradicted the Apostle of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And then he continues, and had I compelled the people to abandon their actions and place them in their correct positions as per the teachings during the lifetime of the Apostle of Allah, my army would have dispersed from me until I would be left alone with a very few of my followers who know my merit and my designated leadership from the Book of Allah and the tradition of the Apostle. So this is what went on after this great, or better say, grand deviation.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies, it clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is, do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We cannot go into the details of how the laws of Allah were changed according to the whims of those who ruled. However, we can somehow suffice with some of the examples. Although the Holy Prophet ﷺ did not permit nafila prayers to be conducted in congregation, one of the misguided caliphs, due to his personal whim, changed that and allowed it and even encouraged it, such that in one of his sermons expressing his sorrow on this issue, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam says, وَاللَّهِ لَقَدْ أَمَرْتُ النَّاسَ أَنْ لَا يَجْتَمِعُوا فِي شَهْرِ رَمَضَانِ إِلَّا فِي فَرِيضَةِ. I swear by Allah, I ordered the people not to gather in the holy month of Ramadan in congregation save during the obligatory prayers. وَأَعْلَمْتُهُمْ أَنَّ اجْتِمَاعَهُمْ فِي النَّوَافِلْ بِدْعَةِ. And I informed them that their congregation in nawafil prayers is an innovation and bid'ah. And at the end, Imam alayhi salam says, I feared that they would revolt within my army. And also in this regard, in a comprehensive but succinct tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, حلال محمد حلال أبدا إلى يوم القيامة. The things made lawful by Muhammad will remain lawful till the day of resurrection. وحرامه حرام أبدا إلى يوم القيامة. And the things made unlawful by Muhammad will remain unlawful until the day of resurrection. So, we wish to suffice with these examples of how laws were freely interpolated by some people. Allama Amini, in his Mawsu'a al-Ghadir, he has explored other lapses of the caliphs preceding Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the beauty of this masterpiece is that it heavily refers to Sunni sources to convince our Sunni brethren about the traditions quoted. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
In the limelight. The U.S. Capitol Police announced on Monday, 23rd of August, that they had cleared a lieutenant who fatally shot a rioter inside the Capitol during the January 6 attack, after an extensive investigation found that he acted lawfully and potentially saved lawmakers and aides from serious harm or even death. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Capitol Police Clear Officer Who Shot Rioter, Saying He May Have Saved Lives. U.S. Capitol Police announced on Monday, 23rd of August, that they had cleared a lieutenant who fatally shot a rioter inside the Capitol during the January 6 attack, after an extensive investigation found that he had acted lawfully and potentially saved lawmakers and aides from serious harm or even death. The department's decision to formally close the case followed a determination in April by the U.S. Justice Department that charges against the officer were not warranted. In the shooting death of Ashley Babbitt, a 35-year-old Air Force veteran, on 6th of January this year. Ashley Babbitt was among a throng of Donald Trump supporters that began smashing its way through the entrance to the Speaker's lobby, a hallway just off the House floor, while police officers were evacuating lawmakers from the chamber. According to video of the encounter, as people in the mob shattered the lobby's glass doors, Ashley Babbitt tried to climb through a hole in the glass, and a police lieutenant on the other side fired a single shot, hitting her in the left shoulder. After being taken to hospital, Ashley Babbitt died. The actions of the police officer in this case potentially saved members and staff from serious injury and possible death from a large crowd of rioters, the Capitol Police said on Monday, noting that lawmakers were just steps away. If the doors were breached, the rioters would have immediate access to the House chambers, the statement said. Ashley Babbitt was one of five people who died during the assault on the Capitol building and in the immediate aftermath. She has become a martyr-like figure for some under far right of U.S. politics. Capitol Police investigators determined the officer's conduct was lawful and within department policy, which says a police officer may use deadly force only when the officer reasonably believes the action is in the defense of human life, including the officer's own life, or in the defense of any person in immediate danger of serious physical injury, the statement added. The agency said it would not be identifying the lieutenant because the police officer and the officer's family have been the subject of numerous credible and specific threats for actions that were taken as part of the job of all our officers, defending the Congress, members of Congress, staff, and the democratic process. Lawmakers have credited the Capitol police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt with saving their lives, but increasingly, some politicians on the far right have sought to inflame their base over the shooting incident. One House Republican, Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, who has a history of associating with extremists and white nationalists, accused the police officer of lying in wait to carry out an execution. Former President Donald J. Trump has questioned the shooting of Ashley Babbitt and why the name of the police officer who shot Ms. Babbitt was not released. Donald Trump released a statement this month in which he said Ashley Babbitt was murdered at the hands of someone who should have never pulled the trigger of his gun. "We know who he is," Donald Trump said. Ms. Babbitt's husband has sued to force the release of investigative files related to the shooting, and her family has threatened to seek damages from the Capitol Police for her killing. The Capitol Police Department, like Congress, is not subject to public records requests. Mark E. Schammel, a lawyer who represented the Capitol Police lieutenant, said his client is a decorated veteran who showed tremendous restraint in firing just one shot. He said the lieutenant was nothing short of heroic as he organized and coordinated the defense of the house on 6th of January this year. His willingness to remain steadfast in the face of hundreds of violent extremist would-be insurrectionists intent on thwarting Congress from performing its constitutional duties was the type of heroism and commitment that the lieutenant was demonstrated in his almost 3 decades of law enforcement service, the lawyer Mr. Schammel said. The lieutenant's conduct saved lives and helped to end the violent insurrection.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Discovering Islam.
The story of Tawheed is not limited to the creation of the world or oneness of God. Another important aspect of Tawheed is that we have to worship the one and only God. But why should we worship God? What is the purpose of worship? Why should we worship a God who does not benefit from our worshiping? And why is worshiping anything beside or in association with God the greatest sin according to the Quran? Man is a worshipping being and cannot be free from worship in one form or another. If we do not worship God, we worship other things, even including our ideas, our aspirations, or our desires. The moment we cease to worship, our life is disrupted.
The word in Arabic for worship is Aliha, which is used in the phrase La ilaha illallah. The word Aliha actually means a number of things. It means to worship. It also means to be obsessed with. It also means to rely on someone in time of need. It also means to be in love with someone. It also means, continuing the idea of obsession, to not be able to think of anyone else, to feel or to miss someone intensely when they're not present. And so when we say La ilaha illallah, we are saying there's no one worthy of worship, or of love, of obsession, of reliance, no one worthy of me turning to them in time of desperation and need other than Allah.
Tawheed in worship is one of the most important aspects of Tawheed, for it's not a matter of belief anymore, but a matter of action as well. It shows how committed one is in their faith. It is the manifestation of the soul and heart of a believer in their practice.
The worship in action includes that your intention, you have to have ikhlas, which means pure sincerity for the sake of God, not your ego, not to please others, not to please society, but to please the one that created you.
Worship is to adore, to praise, and to humble oneself towards the object of worship. The Quran states that some people take their fleeting desires as the objects of their worship.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. أفرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هوا. Have you seen the one who takes his own base desire as his Lord? So associating partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only worshipping an idol. The individual might worship his own lower self. When I'm obeying other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that can be my nafs. That itself is a form of shirk. As we know, we have two different types of shirk. The first type is shirk al-khafi. Shirk al-khafi is the hidden shirk. And the second type is shirk al-jali. It is the apparent one. The apparent one is the person in the temple worshipping, if he's truly worshipping the idol. But the khafi one, the hidden one, the minor shirk, is me taking my lower desire, taking the power, taking the position, taking my wealth as my Lord. And both of these types of shirk takes me to destruction, because it's taking me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All human beings are bound to worship something. It is in our nature to worship. The only thing is, are we picking the right authority, or the Quranic word is ilah, or God, to worship? Quran actually details a few false gods. For example, Hawa, the god of desire. So if we were to become a bird or servants of desire, what would happen to us? We would be destroyed. We would have self-destruction. We would not be able to live our lives in the best way possible. So it is indeed our nature to worship something and our best interest to worship Allah.
You have people who are free of the worship of God, who free themselves of the worship of the Creator. However, that's not to say that it's not replaced by the worship of something else. So you see people who don't worship God end up worshiping earthly pleasures, they end up worshiping money or power, they end up having addictions which become like a kind of worship because there is such a strong dependence on them. So man can free himself of worship of God's, man can free himself of God's worship simply because he has the free will to do so. However, that's not to say that it's a choice without consequence.
In our day-to-day experience, we can see how sometimes we are humbled to and infatuated by our desires. This is because realizing those desires is very important to man, and thus he is prepared to humble himself before anything that may help him to bring about what he wants and to realize his desires. And this is probably how idol worshiping came about.
Idol worship is an aberration of the heart and mind. Idol worship is essentially the ego, because I think all idol worship stems from self-worship. Because there's going to be an element where you're going to be worshipping your ego, because your ego is that veil that prevents you from seeing the truth.
People used to worship idols because they thought they controlled the sources of what they sought. If they wanted a child or money or victory or good harvest, there was a god for each of them who could fulfill their need. It was sheer material need which made them to turn to God. And since God was so transcendent, they sought more immediate deities to talk to.
Many people find it very difficult to understand a transcendental God, a God that is everywhere, but at the same time so far away from us, a God who's all-powerful, but we're so impotent, a God who is living everywhere, but we will die. A God who is powerful to do anything, yet we can struggle to do anything. When there is that very big gap between where we are and where God is, there feels that there needs to be some sort of intermediary to get there. And that is where this idea of idol worship happens. And the idea that they can worship someone who acts as a mechanism to get to the purest God.
The big question is, why has God placed this sense of worship in man? Why are we instructed to worship him? Is he in need of us worshiping him?
Well, I would never want to worship a God that actually benefits from me. That would mean God is not God anymore. It means he's weak, he's needy. God's name is the free. Al-Ghani, he's free, he's independent, he's self-subsisting. That deserves to be worshipped.
Fundamental to the conception of God in Islam and in the Quran is that he is independent. He is needless. Huwa al-ghani. The verse continues, wa antumul fuqaraha. You are the needy. You are the dependent. So God does not need our worship whatsoever.
Wa ma khalaqtu al-jinna wal-insa illa liya'budun. How should we interpret this verse in the Quran, which states that God has not created jinn and human being, but to worship him?
Some people misunderstand this ayah and think God just wants us to just be praying to him all the time and do nothing else, just pray, because we have no other purpose in life. Actually, all the other things, like, it's the same God who said, وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشَ. He put on the earth things for you to live well. He wants you to live well in this world. He wants you to dress well, eat well, sleep well, have a nice family, enjoy yourselves. He wants those things for you. And guess what? When you do them, you are actually fulfilling a command of Allah by utilizing the things He made for you.
People sometimes make objections as to why, if God does exist, He needs to be worshipped. Surely if God exists, He is free of any such need. Why do we have such a needy God who needs to be constantly told that He's right, that needs to be constantly told that He's great? However, really the truth is that, of course, God doesn't need to be worshipped at all. And we don't worship God because it is in any way adding to His being or taking away from it if we are not worshipping Him. We worship God because we need to worship God, because we need to have a sense of grounding and a sense of direction. We worship God as a reminder of who put us on this earth, as a reminder of why we are here, and as a reminder of where we will ultimately end up. If we didn't remind ourselves of God and of His existence every single day, we would very soon forget. And then where would we be? Where would we be? We would be completely lost.
Thus, the only meaning that we can imagine for this verse is that worship brings us closer to Him. And by Him, we mean the absolute perfection.
If I want to get closer to perfection, or if I want to become perfect myself, I need to take this perfection or these attributes from the source of perfection.
Worshipping God is nothing to do with Him requiring it. God is considered to be Ghani. He is needless of any of our worship. But at the same time, it is us who need that worship. We need this opportunity to really excel in this life. Why? Because that will help us in the hereafter, and it will help other people in this world. And that's the core essence of why we are here. We need to have this opportunity to excel.
So what is the purpose in this worship? The purpose in this worship is nothing more than for humankind's benefit, to help humankind move towards those pinnacles of existence and to take on those godlike qualities in their life.
The famous verse which states that God only created man and jinn to worship Him clearly states that the aim of the creation is the journey towards God. And let's be reminded that God is the source of all perfection. Hence, the conclusion is this life is about worshipping Him, i.e. is about taking this journey towards perfection.
There remains another essential question here. How should we worship God? Are rituals enough as worship?
Ritual performance is nothing if it isn't a means towards godliness and goodliness. And we see this throughout the Quran. Worship in its truest sense is servitude towards God, to become as God would like one to be. This isn't done through the performance of any ritual. Rituals are purely instrumental.
Worship means obedience. Worship means submission to the will of God. Worship does not mean that you constantly sit in the direction of Mecca and continue to pray and pray and pray. As long as you are living your life according to the will of God and you are not disobeying, every single breath that you are taking is worship.
Too often we talk about worship solely in terms of ritual. We talk about worship solely in terms of doing things. Whereas worship in itself is the remembrance of God as God should be remembered. It is the remembrance of God in a way that reminds us of His greatness. And if what we are doing, whatever ritual we are performing, is not reminding us of the greatness of God, then really it is not an act of worship, it is mere ritual.
In other words, anything we do in this world in remembrance, love, and obedience of God can be regarded as an act of worship.
to summarize it is to love God, to obey Him, and to worship Him. And that translates in many things. Praying 5 times a day, doing dhikr, which is the remembrance of God. Actually being in service to your fellow human beings is also a form of worship if you're doing it for the sake of God. And that's worship in action in a way, when you're doing actions like serving others and giving acts of charity. Because we believe the acts of worship, but the only true worship if you do it for the sake of God.
Worship is an evolving process. And when one worships with an understanding of what God is, one always has to work towards perfection.
So our ritual fasts and prayers are not the only acts of worship. Our love for our family and relatives, any help extended to fellow human beings, to win bread for our dependents, could as well be regarded as acts of worship.
Dhikr is remembrance. Look at the signs. Look at what is around you. And you will get the feeling that He is with you even though you don't see Him. And the final step, which is excellence, al-ihsan, is to worship Him as if you are seeing Him. But how? Out of love. In kuntum tuhibbun Allah. Worshipping is to love, is not only to abide by the rules. You abide by the rules because you love. And you show your love because you abide by the rules. So it's a virtuous cycle, and this is the meaning of worshipping.
Apart from the acts we offer as worship, worship has an essence. Its essence is based on placing one's hope and fear in God alone.
Tawheed in worship means that the type of humility, obedience, fear, and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection, because it emancipates human heart and soul from all other types of worship.
Idol worshipping is considered a great sin, and the reason for this is because the very feeling instilled in man to bring him closer to God is diverted to leave him further away from God.
When you have a relationship with the one who is all perfect, because that's who He is, and He is the most beautiful, and He's the most perfect, and He's the most loving, then you want to emulate those qualities in your life. You want life around you to be more and more beautiful. You want more and more love in your life. You want more and more, you know, better and better things in your life. Because at the end of the day, this quest will come to a conclusion when you finally meet Him and you actually get to see perfection itself.
But should we fear God or love Him? Are fear and love compatible with each other? The Quran actually advises us that at the same time that we love God, we have to fear Him as well. And different experiences of fear are mentioned in the Quran, or different levels of fear. Taqwa, khashya, shafaqa, rahba are but some examples.
The relationship between fear and love is one which is seen as a dynamic in Islam, okay, and often portrayed as such. They can be two sides of the same coin, okay? And fear and love are not wholly incompatible. Absolutely not are they wholly incompatible. Having said that, the predominant ethos of the Quran is one of love, okay, as is encapsulated in that repeated reference to God as being Rahman and being Rahim, the unqualified giver.
Every relationship comes with love and fear. Why is it so hard to understand with God? We have to love Him and we have to be afraid that He might be upset about something. But if your relationship in this world, if your relationship is only love and you're never afraid, like if I think about my wife, yeah, I love her, but I'm never afraid of disappointing her. I'm never worried about saying something that might hurt her feelings. I might think the relationship is perfect, but she might actually think that I don't care about her anymore. If my relationship with her is only about fear, oh my God, she's going to get angry.
if I say something, she's going to get so mad, right? Then over time, I will lose all love for her. All that's left is fear.
We have to start with loving him. Once we base our understanding on rationality, then you cannot but love him. Fear, of course, there are consequences to our decisions. These consequences can be consequences between us and God, or things that affect people around us. Punishments is part of the equation, is part of the existence. You take the wrong decision. The Quran states is that not that God has ascribed certain punishments to this wrong decision. Your wrong decision itself, in reality, has these negative consequences.
Taqwa is the beginning of all those different levels of fear, and it is the beginning of worship. It is faith put to application. It is fear of losing God's support and trying to win his favor. But our fear of God is not purely for the consequences. It is sometimes an awesome experience of his greatness.
Khashya is a fear as a result of knowledge and leads to action. It is when you know the greatness and the magnitude of what you fear, and as a result, you have reverence of it. There is another type of fear mentioned in the Holy Quran, which is referred to as rahb. Rahb is the kind of a fear that makes you very alert, very careful, and does not let you relax. It is like type of fear that the students have during exam time. They're careful, they're restless, and they're concerned about their passing. It is also fear that you're afraid that you'll disappoint the one you love. The final type of fear which is mentioned is shafaqa. Shafaqa is the fear that some harm will come to a person you love. It is that type of fear. It is a fear that is mixed with love, such as the love of a mother for her children. She is fearful out of love for them.
If worshipping God is so important for the perfection of man, what happens if it is directed to concepts, objects, or persons other than God?
It's a divergence from the straight path. Does it have consequences? It does. Because we are meant to direct our thoughts and our actions with the unlimited being that is God. Once we attach ourselves to a limited form of existence, i.e. any form of an idol, because he's limited, our journey towards perfection will be very limited and very short, and it will hinder our progress towards perfection. So to free ourselves and to go back on the straight path to that endless journey towards the absolute perfection, we need to be free from idol worshipping and direct this energy and this fellowship to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now that's because Allah is the reality, and what he invokes besides him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, he is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in his favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted his love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that
the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God. In fact, it is through worshiping God that we can expand and develop our God-given faculties. Associating partners with God would not only stop that process, but it is showing ingratitude towards our Creator. It is only by acknowledging that all beauty comes from God and all praise is due to Him that man can be accomplished. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk more about the creation of man. Until then, peace be with you.
The Light.
An architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with the country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of plants to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in the sprawling city. The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nanchu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas such as snowy mountains, grasslands and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have also been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other.
The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smithsonian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Xiao Qiji is the fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive. There are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Buddha sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of butter and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made its first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special, in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift its function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cleft decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Fatik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
IRIB English Radio.